and welcome to this week's episode of the House of Comments podcast. My name is Emma Burnell. I'm a Labour blogger and I blog at the Scarlet Standard. And this is one of those very, very special episodes where all three hosts of the House of Comments podcast come together. So I am joined tonight by Mark Thompson, a recovering Lib Dem blogger. Hello, Mark.
Hello.
And Nick Dennis, who is a Conservative blogger. Hello.
Hello, Emma. Hi, Emma.
How are you both?
Yeah, good, thanks. I'm kind of thinking when you say we all come together, it's a bit like I'm going to make a really obscure reference now that almost no one will remember, but the two people that do will really like it, which is an animated series from about 1981 called Starfleet. And they had three spaceships and they actually came together to form a big robot that kind of went around stamped on things. And I'm just kind of imagining that's what we're like now, just like a big politics-based robot.
Okay.
Mark, you might have officially left the Lib Dems, but you're still such a Lib Dem.
Thank you.
I'm not sure that was a compliment, Mark.
I'm taking it as one, no matter how it was meant.
Okay, so it's been quite a big week for fairly big politics. The EU bill and the immigration bill were both bandied around in the Commons, largely between Tories rather than between the Tories and other parties. The EU bill was, as I understand it, fell in the House of Lords because it was talked out. And the immigration bill was voted against by Labour, so, and with the Tories abstaining, it didn't pass. But this has caused some bad blood between, further bad blood, perhaps you might say, between David Cameron and his backbenchers. Nick, would that be a fair assessment?
Well, as a Conservative activist, this week has been quite frustrating in many ways because the EU has been a massive issue within the Tory party for a number of years. I mean, ever since I've been interested in politics, way before I even joined the Conservative Party, it was a massive fault line within our party. And last year when Cameron stood up and said the Conservative Party will offer an EU referendum, I thought, well, that's brilliant because that's a policy that we can all unite around, which essentially is give power to the people, let them decide whether they want to stay in and out of this relationship which has changed over the last 40 years. So I was actually really, really happy. And then when I went to Tory party conference, there wasn't really much chatter about Europe, and a lot of it was about other stuff such as cost of living and all those things. And so I thought, yes, that the EU referendum has finally put this to bed as sort of an issue of tension within the party. So this week has just completely had me thumping my head against my desk, because no matter what you think about the EU, the issues around the EU, the amendments that were put forward by Rabb and Mills were essentially illegal and wouldn't have worked within the structure of the EU. Now, you shouldn't put forward amendments which actually don't work within the law that we have for a start. And if the problem is the EU and that's why they won't work, then surely what you should do is actually concentrate on the bigger picture, which is to get an EU referendum. And the only way at the moment that could happen is if you have a Conservative majority or the Conservative as the main party in the next coalition. And people tend to vote for united parties. I mean, what I thought, there were two very interesting comments by backbench MPs this week. Firstly, Douglas Carswell, in the middle of the week, changed his mind heroically, I think. He originally signed up to these amendments, but then he wrote, having spent all my adult life campaigning to get Britain out of the EU, perhaps we outers need to grow up if we are to achieve our goal. And he basically said, I'm not going to back this now because I think what we need to do is we need to focus on what really counts. And I thought that was very, very good. And then Mark Pritchard, another one who has been quite vocal on this, in a sort of quite interesting tweet, said, the majority of the Conservative MPs, apart from 30 irreconcilables, will show new discipline, but only if number 10 doesn't take them for granted. So that was a sort of half handshake in there. So hopefully number 10 can sort of deal with the Mark Pritchard in order to make sure that we can actually focus on what's important, which is governing and trying to get a majority so we can have an EU referendum.
If I were a Tory backbencher, though, I would completely I completely understand their motivations, because Cameron does back down a lot. He is easily malleable by his backbenchers. So the temptation just to keep going because you know you'll get what you want eventually must be extremely strong.
But I mean, I can easily see why you say that. But in this context, I mean, he can't give them what they want. So these amendments were you know, if it was to get him to back down on anything, well, they didn't really work. All they did was stick pins and needles into the leadership without being able to achieve their ultimate aim, which essentially would be leaving the EU, and that's or at least. Adapting how the EU works in order to, so we, these type of amendments can work, and that could only happen if we have an EU referendum.
Mark, where were the Lib Dems in all this?
I have no idea. I'm not a Lib Dem anymore, Emma. I don't have to answer for them.
No, but you have to answer for them in terms of this podcast, otherwise it's a bit unbalanced.
Well, I mean, we know the Lib Dems' views on Europe. You know, they're strongly in favour of it. Well, not just Europe, the physical continent, but obviously membership of membership of the EU. And so, I mean, it's not really surprising to see that they conspired with Labour peers to basically talk out the amendment that would have set the referendum in legislation, and therefore would have made things awkward for, say, an incoming Labour Prime Minister, say Ed Miliband, in a couple of years' time, who then might have to spend time legislating to undo the referendum. And frankly, I think that would be a very difficult political sell. So, but I actually think that may strengthen the Tory chances, because come the election, they're going to be able to more credibly say, if we do not get a majority Conservative government, we are not going to get this referendum. And that might help to, I won't say shoot, but perhaps, you know, slightly strangle UKIP's fox.
We've heard that before, haven't we?
Well, yeah, I know, but in this case, there's some concrete evidence for it now, because there was a chance for there to be a referendum on the statute books, and Lib Dems and Labour have conspired to prevent it from happening. So that, I think, could play to the Tory strengths. But just coming to the immigration thing, I mean, I think this just demonstrates how ideological things are getting now, because the fact that you've got these amendments that actually were illegal, and that Theresa May actually stood up in the Commons and said were illegal, and however much her and David Cameron and other ministers might have wanted to do something on this issue, my understanding is that if they'd have voted for this, they'd have had to resign because they'd have contravened international law. So they weren't able to do that. And it, as Nick says, it's crazy. Well, he might not have used the word crazy, but I'll use the word crazy, that we're in a situation where backbench MPs are proposing things that are against international law. And how can we have ended up in this position? It can only be because things have just got so ideological now that they really don't even care about whether it's compatible with international law anymore. They just want to push these amendments through.
If they had managed to push the amendments through, if Labour hadn't basically just gone, oh, fuck it, we better do some the grown-up thing here.
thank you, Labour. I just have to say thank you for clearing up this mess for us.
Yeah. If we had decided to go, you know what, it's much funnier to leave them off on their own. let's just not turn up. What would have happened? You say that David Cameron would have had to have resigned.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, ultimately, what would have happened if it had gone through, then it would have gone to the Lords, and the Lords would have taken it apart.
No, sorry.
And made it legal.
I was being very specific. If Cameron had have voted for it, then he'd have had to have resigned, because he'd have voted for something that was against international law. And apparently, well, this is certainly what I've heard anyway. But, you know, if it had gone through, yeah, I'm sure it would have been killed eventually. But yeah.
Very, very. And how much parliamentary time has been dedicated to playing these games?
Well, if you talk about the EU referendum, no government parliamentary time has been dedicated to it. It's all been on the Friday afternoon or Friday day. So, yeah.
Dealing with things that aren't impossibilist.
Well, if you look at a lot of the private members' bills that people propose on Friday, I think this is probably the most sensible one.
Oh, I've seen some fairly sensible private members' bill. I actually passed one back in my campaigning days.
Oh, you're talking about Peter Bowen's Margaret Thatcher Day, are you?
Yes, of course. I was on the doorsteps. I was on the trenches. It was to do with micro energy. It was when I was running CERA, so it was good days. Anyway, we digress. So basically, a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing, I think, is where we're all coming together.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it signifies nothing. I think it really, I mean, this all goes into the sort of atmosphere now where we're sort of already into an election type of campaigning atmosphere, and I think many of the conservatives are thinking about, of the electoral point, i.e., we want to do this, and so we can, as Mark said, so we can say it, and Labour and Lib Dems didn't. They're also, I mean, there is an eye to putting pressure on the Conservative manifesto as well to make sure it's very robust in these views. So it's a bit more than heat and noise, but yes, it is. I mean, I think what we'll find as we go on later this year, there'll be less and less bills and legislation because essentially the coalition government is basically coming apart, really.
And I think that might be a good note on which to move on to our next topic, which is that Baroness Sally Morgan, who is currently chair of Ofsted, will not be having her contract renewed when it comes up, despite the fact that Michael Gove has previously, whose decision it is, has previously described her as doing a superb job. She has said this is because she is not a Conservative and they want to put a Conservative into the role. This has been criticised by Michael Gove's deputy, David Laws, who's junior minister in the Department of Education. So it's become a coalition squabble as well as a Labour Tory squabble. Nick, has Gove gone too far? Is he politicising Ofsted, or is this?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't know enough about Ofsted and how it works, but he did appoint her, so he knew exactly what her political affiliations were when he appointed her. So I don't think it necessarily is to do with that. I mean, on the broader issue, it's very interesting. I mean, firstly, of course, when Labour were in government, they appointed lots of people who were Labour supporters, and secondly, I think well. It, sh shouldn't we just be a bit more open about this? If a government gets elected, they obviously want to appoint somebody who's capable to do the job, but also they want to appoint somebody who believes in the overall mission of what's trying to be achieved, and that person is more likely to be a supporter of that political party, I would have thought. So I don't think this is something that we should be completely scandalised about, that if one government tends to appoint more from their own mindset than another government. I mean, ultimately, I would like to have a lot of these quangos brought back into, brought back into government and brought back into maybe parliamentary committees having say over appointments and how they're run. And I think in general, the way our government runs is a bit too detached in this level. So if I was going to go for any reforms, it would be along those lines.
It's quite interesting to hear a conversation start with talk about Michael Gove and then end with government being too detached. That's generally the accusation that's thrown at Mr. Gove.
Well, I mean, I don't, I suppose what I'm trying to say is I don't think this is, I don't really see an issue in appointing people who agree with you philosophically. And I think, he appointed Sally Morgan and she was Labour, so I'm not sure she's completely accurate with her opinion.
I mean, I think that it is true that most governments do appoint people who would be more likely to pursue the kind of policies they're trying to put in. The problem is, of course, that these quangos' lifespans don't last the same amount of time as a government. So you have a lot of overlap, which does lead to insecurity, to too much job change, there has been a lot of replacement of people over the last few years, and not like for like. And maybe we should be more honest and just say, we'll appoint the people we like and you'll appoint the people you like and it's up to whoever's in government. But does that then lead to instability and a politicisation of what were originally envisaged as non-political organisations?
Well, firstly, I know we should let Mark in soon, but firstly, with fixed term parliaments, it should be quite easy to match up terms if this is what we're going to do. And secondly, I don't think we should see politicisation as being a dirty word. I mean, if a party or a coalition wins, essentially they've gained most votes, and so that I think it's completely reasonable to operate in a more American type system, be open about, we're trying to get through a program that we believe in, and that is part of politics.
So when Ed Miliband, when he becomes Prime Minister, appoints people to quangos who are former union officials, who are from the left, leftist academics, leftist journalists, you'll be fine with that.
I didn't complain during Tony Blair and Gordon Brown's government.
But they did appoint a lot of people that weren't. I mean, if you look at some of the people they brought into government, they're some of the most conservative people we've got. Lord bloody Freud, we're responsible for that. Okay.
Yeah, well, I mean the Conservatives, I mean the The coalition has also appointed Labour people and non-affiliated people. So
that is true. I'm going to jump in, seeing as I'm not being invited.
Yes, come in, please.
Yeah, I'll join the party. Not literally. So Alan Milburn, for example, was appointed to head some commission, wasn't he? So was John Hutton. So it's not as if Labour is the only party that has been able to have been, you know, kind of cross-party in that respect in appointing people. But I have to say, I really don't understand why this has suddenly become such a big hot topic, and it's like, you know, one of the main stories on the BBC News website for 3 days and all over the media. Because precisely as Nick says, this has gone on for decades. You know, parties that are in power appoint people, you know, in Margaret Thatcher's famous term, you know, are they one of us? I mean, it might not be as explicit as that, but that's what's going on. We know that's what goes on.
It happens when someone steps down, though. They don't get stepped down.
But no, it was a three-year position, and the 3 years has come to an end, and it's up for renewal, and it's not been renewed. I mean, she's not been sacked. She's just not been re-employed.
You wouldn't move someone from that if they still wanted to do it, unless you were putting somebody else in.
But
I think it's what has made it news.
It sounds to me, Emma, like you're trying to.
As long as things have been going on, I'm saying what makes it news is that she has been stepped down rather than is stepping down.
Well, it doesn't really feel to me like news. However, what I do think is that a little bit like what Nick said. If we think that this is a problem, rather than just focus on Gove and what a nasty man Michael Gove is, that he's fired this really nice person who was really good at her job, what we actually need to look at are the underlying structures. And I'm not convinced, like Nick said, that we should be going for an American-type system. I mean, what happens in America is that they spend 3 months. So they have the election, and then, you know, the president is president-elect at the start of November, and then it's not until the end of January that they're actually sworn into office. So they have 3 months, they set up these transition teams, and they literally appoint thousands and thousands of people to all of these key posts. Most of those people will be, you know, party-aligned to either Democrat or Republican, depending on who's coming in. I don't think that's good for stability, and especially in a polarized country like the US, where politics is so divisive right now, and it's like a pendulum swinging backwards and forwards over and over again. I don't necessarily think that is good for good continuation of good governance. And I thought in this country, we weren't really supposed to have that. We were supposed to have an independent civil service. So I would question whether the fact that this goes on is a good thing. I'm just surprised that it's news because it has been going on for so long.
So should Quangos really come under the civil service banner again? Well, they have a funny status, don't they? Really, Quangos. Yeah. They're not part of government, but they're not part of the civil service, but they are related to government.
They are one of us.
Yeah, yeah. I attended an event a few years ago called Bonfire of the Quangos, which, funnily enough, Douglas Carswell, who you mentioned earlier on, was at, and he was one of these people who's very keen on basically getting rid of Quangos. And yet, although this government had a lot of high-minded rhetoric when it came in about what it was going to do about Quangos, I think, if I'm right, they've actually increased the number of Quangos.
And they added a few more, but they did scrap of quite a lot. I know a lot of people who lost jobs in Quangos.
Yeah, but I think they created quite a lot more, and quite a lot of the ones that they created were kind of through the back door as well. And I think that illustrates the problem, because although instinctively I'm not a fan of the idea that you know, these things are not politically accountable, there is a real problem in that politicians find the easiest answer to a lot of questions, a lot of difficult questions, is we'll appoint a commission, or we'll, you know, we'll have an inquiry, or we'll appoint a judge-led inquiry. That seems to be a favourite of Ed Miliband's. And, you know, and these things are then supposedly independent of government and therefore not subject to political interference. And I think unless and until we can get to a position in this country where politicians are just trusted again, like they used to be many years ago, then I think we're going to struggle to ever get rid of Quangos. But we have this kind of weird halfway house at the moment where we have Quangos, but then the Quangos are kind of have placed men and women put into them. And then you're just going to end up with this argument over and over again. But I'll just repeat, the idea that this is all Gove being a nasty man is just silly. I don't understand why it's become such a big story right now.
Well, I've already gone over why I think so twice. Anyway, so what about laws? Is this the start of the differentiation strategy?
Well, go on, Nick, you go first.
I was just going to say it's continuation. I think it started almost on the 2nd of January, really, this differentiation strategy. So, but yes, in answer to your question, yes. I mean, I think Lib Dems are one of the areas of voters which are pretty still keen-ish on Lib Dems is teachers. So I think they'll make a lot of noise for teachers over the next year.
So, and it's, I mean, I read the Fraser Nelson piece today. I don't know if either of you have read it. But it seems that his belief is very much that this is not led philosophically by Laws disagreeing with Gove, but electorally seeing the advantage in disagreeing with Gove.
Completely. I mean, I'd be very surprised if David Laws really cares if it's Sally Morgan or not. I mean, I think, him saying he wasn't consulted over this, I think doesn't sound great, because he's the minister whose area is sort of overlooks Ofsted. But yes, I mean, I think, Sally Moores or not, I don't think he has any particular issues. I just think he enjoyed making loud noise and sort of maybe to nicely pivot between you and Mark on the news thing. I think the Lib Dems or whoever, I assume it's Lib Dems, did very well at getting this in the press, because it was in all the papers and on the BBC News. So it was a very good spinning operation.
Yeah, I mean, as regards Laws, you described him as a junior minister, Emma, but I think we all know he's more than that. You know, he's one of Nick Clegg's closest confidants and a very, very senior member of the party, and, you know, was part of the coalition negotiation team. So I think the fact that he's waded in on it is more significant than if it was just, you know, junior minister for paperclips had made some comment about something. But I also think that if the Lib Dems are that, you know, troubled about what's going on with education, they should have made it part of the, part of the coalition negotiations that they got the education department. You know, if it's seen as such a core Lib Dem thing, and they didn't, you know, they negotiated to get some of the other departments like the environment and business and so on and so forth. So in the end, it's going to be the Secretary of State that's going to ultimately make these decisions. And the fact that Laws wasn't consulted, well, you could argue maybe he should have been, but it wouldn't be the first time that we've seen things going on in departments where, you know, the Secretary of State is a Tory and there's a junior Lib Dem who hasn't got a clue what's happening.
Well, no, it wouldn't be the first time. But equally, I mean, if the issue is education, there have been things happening for 4 years. It's kind of, where have you been, guys? You know, if you want to differentiate yourself over education, you probably should have done it while all the legislation was being passed. Not now that the legislation is bedded in, there's very little actually happening. So you're doing it over the sacking of one person rather than the complete changes to education policy.
Yeah, you might have to get a Lib Dem on next week, Emma, to defend that, because I'm not going to.
A cynical person would say that the important thing was the generation of heat and seemed to be argued for at this stage, sort of coming up with an election a year away. But that's what a cynical, and we're not cynical here, so we say such a thing.
Okay, so as I said at the beginning of the podcast, it has been a dramatic time, a dramatic week in politics. And right at the end of the week, on Friday night, the measures that are going to change the way the Labour Party relates to trade unions, the way they elect their leader, were announced. It will now be the case that if you want to vote for the leader of the Labour Party, you have to be a member or an associate member of the Labour Party. You have to, if you are a trade union member, you have to opt in twice. You have to first opt in with your payments and say, yes, I do want my money to go to the trade union, to the Labour Party. And then again, opt in to say, yes, in addition to that, I wish to become an associate member of the Labour Party. This would mean that votes in the Labour leadership contest, for example, were all sent from Labour Party headquarters rather than through the affiliates. It also means that Labour will probably lose quite a large, substantial portion of their funding, because at the moment it's assumed that all people who opt into the political fund are opting to support Labour, whereas now that has to be a conscious choice, and we know that not every trade unionist does support Labour. I mean, at least something like 20-30% of Conservatives. They're quite brave moves, if saying to your party that you'll lose money. But it does seem to be that the tightrope between what the leadership wanted and what the trade unions wanted has been well walked. I'm happy to quote someone fairly senior in the party saying we got more than we expected and that they're very pleased with it. But it does seem to be that the trade union bosses are also backing it. What do you guys think about this?
Mark, do you want to go through first?
Yeah. Well, can we separate out two things here? Because my understanding is that the changes on the one member, one vote are very likely to go through. I mean, obviously, we'll wait and see what happens at the special conference, but that's certainly what's probably going to happen. But as regards to the funding, hasn't that been slightly kicked into the longer grass, where it's going to be about 5 years before they, so it's kind of a phase thing where it'll come in. And in 5 years' time, we're going to be in the run-up to the 2020 election. So it wouldn't at all surprise me if whoever's Labour leader at that point decides to kick it even further into the long grass. Because I remember when this story broke, we actually had, if you remember, Emma Sonny Hundle on. And he actually knew this story, and I think you knew it as well. He'd had it embargoed, and kind of, you know, talked about it, and that was the first literally I'd heard of it when he mentioned it to me, and I was really surprised, and I thought it was a really, really brave move. But it seems a bit less brave if the financial side of it has been kicked into the long grass. So am I mistaken about that, or is that right?
I'm happy to inform you that that's not the case.
Okay.
Basically, it's an administrative thing. What every new trade union member from as soon as this is passed at the special conference, giving that it is passed at the special conference, will then be asked to opt in this way.
Okay.
And then the others will be passed over on a rolling basis over a period no longer than 5 years. So a lot of it will happen before 5 years. It's not all going to happen in a lump in 5 years' time. Okay. It's that these are a long, difficult administrative things to get right, to pass people's details over from one organisation to another. So it will happen in tranches.
Okay, but what that will probably mean is that for the 2015 election, the coffers won't suffer very much, because we'll only be in the early stages of that process, won't we?
Well, I suspect that if given this will pass in March, it will start to have an effect, but it won't have as big an effect. But it's still, you're talking about a time the party wants to ramp up its spending.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's not going to have that kind of money from that source to ramp up. It's still very, you know, a massive thing to do.
Okay, well,
the right thing to do. And I don't think we should pick holes in doing the right thing because it doesn't happen the second you want it to.
No, hang on. No, I just wanted to be clear on that, because I didn't know precisely what was happening with the funding side of it. So the answer to...
The thing I should mention is that there's been some fairly wacky conspiracy theories out there about the OMOV. Now, were Labour to have a leadership contest during this five-year period, the only people, and I have this from the horse's mouth, the only people who can vote in that are people who have done the double opt-in, in terms of, you know, they are Labour Party members.
OK, so the answer to your question then from me is that my view is the same as it was when we talked about this first a few months ago, which is that I do think it's a very brave thing for Ed Miliband to do. I wasn't trying to pick holes in it. I was trying to be clear about what the situation is. I think going for one member, one vote is a very good thing, although, you know, I would have to say it's probably overdue. I do think the way Ed Miliband was elected did seem very peculiar to people outside of the Labour movement. And, you know, I can understand why it needs to be done. At the same time, I think it's also brave of Ed Miliband to do it, because it does expose the fact that had this system been in place, David Miliband would have won. He wouldn't even be leader.
That's not necessarily true, because if you look, George Eaton has done the figures. And if you think about who's likely to opt in from the trade unions, actually Ed Miliband has more votes than David Miliband by quite a big margin. So it's just that he would have been voted in by these associate members under one member, one vote.
Well, Emma, that's not true, though, is it?
I would look at the George Eaton piece, because he's worked out the figures.
No, hang on. No, I'm quite happy to go away and look at it afterwards. But what would be different is that what happened with the union votes this time was that they sent out all this literature that included, you know, Ed Miliband pictures and his name and Vote Ed and all of that. And that wouldn't be able to happen under the new system.
No, that wouldn't be able to happen. But it's how influential you really, truly think that is.
Pretty influential.
Union members, for example, in 1994, lots of union members, despite there being no union nominations for him at all, a vast majority of them voted for Tony Blair. Lots of union members this time around voted for David Miliband, just fewer than voted for Ed Miliband. And actually Ed Miliband got more votes. It is it's just not true to say that we know for sure that Ed Miliband wouldn't have won under this system. And the other thing is the MPs' votes were massively overweighted, which again went in David Miliband's favour, which wouldn't happen this time round. One member, one vote, including one member of parliament.
Yeah, you're right about the MP side of things. I'm still sceptical about the union side of things. But, you know, we can't rerun what happened in 2010. My point is that there is a very strong feeling that David Miliband would have won. And irrespective of what you think the real situation is, George Eaton might have written, the whole point is, Emma, I was saying it's a brave thing to do because it opens up that whole question again. Irrespective of what the actual situation is, it does open up that question.
Well, only if that's the question that you really think is worth focusing on, which I'm not entirely sure it is, because A, you can't ever run a counterfactual and know the truth, and B, what's the point? Nothing's going to change. David Miliband's not coming back from America to suddenly be leader of the Labour Party.
Yeah, but it gives the party and Ed Miliband's enemies a chance to raise it and rake over it again, and for David Cameron to do his flashman posturing about, you know, what he did to his brother. That's why it's brave. I'm actually complimenting him. You seem to be taking it as if I'm criticising him.
You enjoy playing to the Labour Party. I know that, Mark.
Oh, well, I'll jump in here. I was just laughing, listening away laughing. But I suppose on that specific point, in 97, after Haig won the leadership, he changed the system of how leaders are chosen in the Tory party. And the system he chose would have been, if that had been in place, Ken Clark probably would have won and he wouldn't have won. So, you know, there is a precedent. You know, it has happened before. And, I don't think it really affects, it didn't seem to affect Haig's leadership particularly. In terms of the actual suggestion, I don't have strong views on it, apart from I think it does look better than the current system. So, and obviously this is for the Labour Party to sort out themselves. But I think the funding is very, very interesting, because with the risk of funding, I can see only two possible solutions that the Labour leadership have thought of. The first one is, well, the union movement will have nowhere to go, and they will still either give money to the Labour Party, or they'll promote campaigns which are sympathetic to Labour, not necessarily give money to the Labour Party, but promote campaigns against the cost of living cuts or whatever, so which will still benefit them. Secondly, I wonder if Labour win, or if Labour and Lib Dems win and join a coalition, they'll have a look again at state funding of political parties, because I know the Lib Dems are very keen at adapting how parties are funded, and one of the problems has always been is that the Tories, and when you get the three parties in the room, Tories and Labour never manage to agree, because Labour have this one big chunk from unions and the Tories have another big chunk from rich backers, and they won't deal with each other's problems. Now, if you remove this from Labour's equation, then they'll be more motivated to try and solve the issue. So I think in some ways, if the Tories don't win the next election, it could be a very, very interesting time for them and how they operate because of that.
I think that's true. I think that, I mean, Miliband has come out and said he wants funding, but he needs that to be cross-party. If he can get the Lib Dems to come back to the table and agree to work with them on that, they could certainly make this some form of agreement, whether they need to do that in a coalition or whether it's something they simply work together in government under a Labour government. If Labour win the next election, or if Ed Miliband is in Prime Minister, either way, I do think it's going to be an issue that comes back, definitely.
So I think that's a really interesting thing. I mean, I will just moving sort of slightly outside this story, I thought Emma, you wrote a great blog this week about Arne Graf, and how the political party should change.
Based on it, thank you.
No, it's good. I mean, it's a subject really close to my heart in general. I write about it a lot, about about the Tory party itself. But I mean, there's one line I like to pick out of it, where you said membership of political parties is not declining because party membership is just too much damn fun. Whisper it. And I thought that was so true. And I think obviously what Labour's doing is very wonkish, and most people won't. You know, I think it's important, but most people won't be interested. But there is a fundamental issue about how society and political parties interact, and I think basically political parties need to move away from membership, sort of a membership of duty, towards involvement in specific issues and coming together the party. And I think this, what Labour's doing, is sort of a small step towards acknowledging that those who are involved should have a say as much as those who want to be members. And I think that's quite an important step.
I completely agree. I've actually got a piece coming out in The Guardian tomorrow, so I'll send you the link on that.
Okay, good.
But yeah, I think it is all part of the movement within Labour, which has caused its own internal tensions, as you might imagine, which is about, you know, dispersing power. And the reason I wrote the piece on Arne Graf is that there seemed to be some evidence of internal tensions over the move to community campaigning. But I think it is just, it's part of the inevitable movement as to where politics is going. You've got to disperse power much more widely within your party and within your supporters and just make it something far more attractive to be part of.
And it's not just about membership as well. That's the, I think, because, you know, party membership has been declining, but political activity in some ways has been going up because people, you know, in some ways people create their own manifestos by joining lots of different single issues, and they pick from the smorgasbord that's out there of different things that are going on. And they, you know, the idea of joining one organisation which speaks for you on an overarching load of topics is quite alien to how we operate in the current world. And I think political parties are very slow to catch up with that, and this is why they're declining. But you know, I think the Arne Graf stuff is interesting, and also I do think, you know, trying to get union members to be involved and not necessarily be proper members, I think, is the right way political parties should look to involve people who are sympathetic but wouldn't necessarily want to become proper members.
Mark, as someone who's decided that the whole arc of membership is not for him, would you say that's the way things are going?
Yeah, I think so. And I think there's a lot in what Nick says about the idea. It's a pretty dated idea, isn't it, that you join a party and then that party is going to represent your view on, you know, all issues, and you agree with everything that party you know says. Now, we all know that that isn't really how it works, but I'll be honest with you, one of the reasons I didn't join a political party for so many years, I mean, I only joined at the age of kind of 33 34, 5 years ago, even though I've been interested in politics for many years, is partly because of that, because there was never really a party that fully represented my views. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if that's one of the reasons why lots of other people don't join political parties either. But again, there is a lot of political activity. You know, never a day goes by where there isn't some protest group or some petition. You know, in the internet age now, there's, you know, dozens of petitions every day, you know, hundreds of petitions probably being brought forward, and, you know, ideas being promulgated. And I think when you talk to people, you sometimes find that they actually are interested in politics and political ideas. They just don't really connect that with what political parties per se are doing. And for my own personal point of view, I did a blog post earlier today, actually, which was the five things I learned being an active member of a political party. I did a listicle because it's zeitgeisty.
That sounds interesting.
And well, four of them were kind of, you know, more general points, and then the fifth one was a more personal point. But within that, you know, I've made the point that you know, it's there are ways in which it's quite difficult being an active member of a party. You know, certainly if you want to stand for election, and it costs money, even if it just comes down to, you know, the petrol that you might have to, you know, put in your car to drive around, and, you know, do the canvassing that you need to do, and, you know, then there's kind of regular activities with fundraising. And in my case, the Lib Dems in my constituency are a very small party, and there are only a few active members, so the burden of that then falls disproportionately upon the members that are active. And, you know, there are all sorts of other things as well. And, you know, they aren't really the reasons why I decided to leave. We went at length over the reasons why I decided to leave the Lib Dems, and it's a kind of disillusion more with kind of national politics and how it's played out. But yeah, I do think that most people, the vast majority of people, think political activists are a bit weird. And I think that's sad, because actually I have a massive respect for political activists of all parties. You know, they get out there and they try and make a difference and they try and do something. And I think that's a really good thing. And I wish that they were a lot more respected by people. But I guess that's wishing for the, you know, that's whistling in the wind somewhat.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be lovely, but and most people who get into politics, from whatever party they get into politics, do it for all the right reasons. They may make what I would consider to be wrong choices with those right reasons, but they are the right reasons. They're well motivated. They're civic minded, motivated people.
Yeah, and I think that gets forgotten. And I think there isn't enough within the general public enough recognition that that's what's going on. One of the things I wrote in my post actually was that, you know, despite the fact that as an active member, I spent money, I didn't get any money, I spent money. A lot of people think that people are just getting into politics for the money. And that's crazy. The only people who really get any kind of decent money out of it are MPs and, you know, people in very senior positions in parties. Most activists spend money, and yet that just isn't recognised at all. That's a civic duty as well.
Yeah, my experience mirrors that completely. I mean, most activists are, you know, are good people, civic minded, who want to do good things. Even the ones you might disagree with, they're getting involved because they want to create what they believe to be a better place. And I mean, where I'm living, you know, the ward membership and the constituency membership is made up of people. Should we say quite a few people are sort of above the age of 60 or 65 even. And but they're people, they all joined when they were younger. And one of the reasons they joined was because it was a natural thing if you cared about the local community and to be part of the local community. And even though they're members of the Conservative Party, actually they're members of other groups and do other things. And they see it as part of the biggest civic duty. They're not really interested in philosophy or even the EU debates as such, even though they have views. It's what you do to sort of be a part of the community and help it improve. And for some reason that got lost somewhere, and generations that followed didn't really, you know, feel that they needed to be a part of their local party to do that. So it's interesting now trying to bridge that gap, trying to get the people who do care. There are, you know, loads of people who care are involved in political parties.
Can we blame Thatcher? It feels like something we should probably blame on Thatcher.
Well, as I've said many times, I'm too young to remember her, so I can't comment on whether that's her fault or not. And if it is her fault, then she's a very, very, very powerful woman.
I'm well, sure it's... Blame Thatcher then, and you won't be able to... contradict us. Excellent.
No, indeed.
I have one final question. What's a listicle?
Did you say what's a listicle?
Yeah.
You're obviously not reading BuzzFeed often enough.
But isn't that just a list?
Yeah, but have you not noticed this trend in the last couple of years of quite a lot of blog posts that you find on like BuzzFeed and Cracked, and it's even slipping into the kind of mainstream media, 5 reasons of such and such, or, you know, the 7 best such and such. It's always in lists of numbers, and it's 5 or 7 or 10 or 11.
Oh, God, yeah, the Green Benches guy does it all the time. It drives me mad.
Yeah, that's a list.
I mean, I'm with Emma on this. If you're going to create a new word, it should be shorter and simpler to say, and listicle is longer and more complicated than list. So we should go back to list.
Although I've just used the word confusal, so what do I know? Okay, so one final topic that we thought we might bring up today. Smoking in cars with children in them. There was an attempt to ban this in Parliament this week, I think.
In the Lords.
The Conservatives and Lib Dems were against. Nick Clegg.
No, I mean, what happened is it came up in the Lords. I'm not sure how, if it was a private members thing, and it passed. I think it's going to come to the Commons, and it'll be a free vote in the Commons. So it's like a backbencher thing, but it's still rumbling away in Parliament.
I know that Nick Clegg has said that he doesn't agree with it. I don't know where the Tories are. So it's a free vote, so everyone can vote how they like.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts on this, Nick? You kind of wanted to bring this
I agree with Nick, actually, oddly enough, on this. I mean, of course, you know, I don't agree with smoking in cars when children are there, but I think laws should be passed when big issues need to be resolved. And, you know, all the anti-smoking lobbying and advertising over the last number of years means that those who smoke regularly in cars where children are the kind of people who won't really listen to laws. I mean, I don't think it's actually a big, big issue. I mean, what's, you know, and you could go on to say, well, where do you draw the line? Should you ban parents from feeding over a certain amount of calories per week to a child? Because that's bad for them as well. Or should you ban children from living near Heathrow? Because obviously places like Richmond and West Drayton have very bad air conditionings. And so living there is probably worse than having 2 journeys per week of 10 minutes with a smoker in a car. So it's and then you get onto the point. So if you did catch somebody, what would you do? Would you take the kid to child services? Would you fine them? Would you criminalise the parent? And could that benefit anything? So once you start asking all these questions, I don't think it's really necessary, and I think it's actually to enforce it is fiddly, complicated, costly, and not clear. So the government should promote it as being terrible, and people should tut-tut and will tut-tut over this, but legislation's too much for me.
Mark?
There's not really much more I can say. I pretty much totally agree with everything that Nick just said.
Aren't those largely the arguments that were used against seatbelt laws?
Possibly. I mean,
now, yeah, almost universally followed.
Well, yeah, I mean, putting seatbelts on in cars, you know, saves people's lives in a very, very clear way. You know, I remember the public information films from the 1970s showing people. There's a horrendous set of public information films called The Blunders. I don't know if you've ever seen them. You get the Charlie Says DVD, that all three of them are on there, and it shows people literally in slow motion going through windscreens. It's horrible. And you know, that's a very clear link. I mean, I think there's a less clear link between, you know, a child, like Nick says, being in a car for 10 minutes twice a week with a smoker, and I don't think I've certainly not seen any robust evidence about that. But even if we accept that there is evidence on that, you know, I just don't think it's enforceable. How are the police, if they're driving down a motorway or down a road, going to be able to look at a car and think, is that person smoking? Is that person not smoking? Well, let's stop them and pull them over. It's just one of these things that's unenforceable. And exactly the sort of people who are going to do this aren't going to give a toss about the law. They just won't care.
Okay, well, I am in favour of this for many reasons. The first being that I think that when we're talking about a balance of rights, which is quite often the argument that's being talked about, this people have a right to smoke in their private property. Children
isn't an argument me or Mark used.
No, I accept that, but it is an argument that's being used out there. So I think it's an argument that deserves rebuttal. Which, you know, I think that when you're talking about that, the child has rights too. And I think the balance of the person least able to enforce their own rights, that then the law is more morally bound to step in. You know, the child has less choice about being in that car than the adult does. The adult can stop the car, pull over and have a fag outside the car much easier than the child gets to choose not to be in the car in the first place. And that's why I think that the moral force should be on the side of the child's health.
But what happens if they're having that fag outside, another car crashes into them and they die? I mean, having no parent who smokes in the car is better than having a parent who smokes in the car, isn't it?
Well, there are always going to be odd consequences in very, very occasional things. I don't think we should make law the lowest common denominator.
And again, I agree, and that's why I don't agree with banning smoking in cars.
That's your argument about, oh yeah, well, it's just the chavvy types who won't listen to the law anyway, who smoke in their cars. And well, actually, we do change things by changing the law, and they wear their seatbelts and probably wouldn't have done 30 years ago, and now they won't smoke in their cars in 20-30 years because we've changed that culture.
I knew plenty of people when I was younger who didn't bother wearing seatbelts. They almost saw it as a badge of honour. I'm not wearing a seatbelt, why would I bother doing that?
How many people do you know now that don't?
I very rarely travel in cars with other people driving. Well, and so
can I just jump in here? But the reason I wear a seatbelt isn't because of the law, it's because I don't want to be responsible for anybody else's harm. And that's, you know, the adverts are really impressive, especially ones where the person is sitting behind the mum and they're arguing or whatever, and then she crashes and you go straight into her and she dies. And for me, that's a lot more powerful than the law. I think banning, you know, smoking in cars with children, I think it's a lot more effective if we use peer pressure and advertising for an issue. I don't think it's a big issue. I can't remember the last time I saw someone smoking in the car with a child. I would never think of doing it myself. And if I was in the car and somebody lit up, I can't imagine anyone would, and I think everyone else in the car would tut-tut about that.
Emma, can I just ask though, the points that Nick raised about, you know, where does this lead next, and, you know, calories and, you know, living near airports and all of that stuff. I mean, how do you respond to those questions? Because I think I'm not normally a fan of slippery slope arguments, but I think in this case it's legitimate because that is where this is leading. Sorry?
Like them when they agree with you.
Well, no. The reason I'm raising it is because when smoking in pubs was first banned, the one of the arguments against doing it was that was a slippery slope, and next thing you know, they'll be banning smoking in cars. And a lot of people said, no, this is just about, you know, the fact that it's in a public place. And of course, we'd never go into people's cars. But now they're going into people's cars. So the kind of slippery slope stuff is starting to happen.
The people who can't help but be there from the people who can help but be there and wish to impart their secondary smoke for some bizarre reason.
So would you ban it in homes as well? Because
no.
Why not? What's the difference between a home and a car?
The car is a much smaller enclosed space, and therefore it's much, much harder to, the density of the smoke is much, much thicker and much, much more damaging. In homes, it's much, much clearer that people, I don't think you can ban it in a home. I think you can ban it in a car.
What's the health issues
are more strengthened in a car. In terms of the airports question, I think there are things that absolutely should be banned. For example, a lot of the kinds of fuel that are used, we should be moving on. There should be far, far better things done in terms of air quality and pollution and fines for those. So I would be fining those people who are polluting the air around airports. And I would be far, far less holding back on that, because I think that they are doing people real damage.
Unfortunately, so far, the fines seem to be paid and nothing seems to be done, though, doesn't it? I mean, I know that's a completely separate issue.
Uneconomic not to change.
I don't really understand the distinction between a house and a car. Okay, you talk about concentration of smoke, but, you know, one mitigation could be that if air conditioning's on or a window's open. I mean, the concentration of smoke in a car with a window down is probably not that different to the concentration of smoke in a room where, let's say, three adults are smoking in a living room where the door's closed and the window's open.
Scientific arguments that are better that back that up. A smaller enclosed space in which children cannot get away is different from smoking in the living room when a child can go to their bedroom.
But ultimately, well, some children can, but children that are under the age of, say, two probably can't, because they're just going to be stuck in the room. It does feel a little bit inconsistent here. I don't think we're really talking about the science here. In the end, what we're talking about is a moral question.
I don't think it's just a moral question. I think there are scientific reasons. You couldn't do this without some scientific understanding of the effects of secondary smoke, for example. You couldn't do this without scientific backup, the fact that smoking is harmful for children, particularly for children. As someone who suffered from childhood asthma and had a parent who smoked in the car, by the way.
So did I. I didn't suffer from childhood asthma, but I did. I was in cars where my parents were smoking.
I know what it's like to feel like you're going to die because your body won't let you breathe. That's not something we should be encouraging in any way. There to be circumstances that would lead to more of that.
Well, you see,
not even Michael Gove is encouraging that.
But Emma, you use the word encourage, so you've completely changed the ground here. No one's encouraging it. What we're saying is that just because you might strongly disapprove of something doesn't mean that you should always bring a law in about it. That's the problem here. Why are we constantly legislating for these things?
Because it saves lives, Mark.
Well, will it, though?
Yes, it will save children's lives. Maybe not hundreds of millions, but some. And that's good enough for me.
But then I don't understand why you wouldn't do it in homes, because that would, by those lights, it would also save lives. So
I think we're now going into a circle. So I think we all understand each other's arguments. I think we should tactfully agree to disagree on this.
I don't agree to that. But anyway, let's move on.
Well, I'm going to have a fag out the window, so yeah.
Oh, you see, I gave up 10 years ago. Can I get the moral high ground now?
When I'm not drinking anymore, but I've got a packet of fags on the sofa, so I definitely get the moral high ground, because I'm saying that I should be subject to this.
Can you drive?
Yes, I can. I've got a new car. It's lovely.
Fair enough. Okay, brilliant. Then yes, you can be subject to this.
That's why the economy's better, because I got a new car. And on that bombshell, I'd just like to take the time to thank Mark and Nick for joining me today.
Thank you.
Also to thank Audio Boo for hosting, and also Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com for our theme music. I'll be hosting next week's podcast.